I am a husband to Susan. Our son Elijah is now an artist living in New York. I am keen to teach about spiritual fitness, biblical theology. I enjoy wilderness travel, cooking, and learning about philosophy, comparative religion, and the Hebrew roots of Christian faith. Our congregation has really been blessed by having such people as Dell and Susan come into our church family, and we are looking forward to Dell's ministry and his talk with us this afternoon. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can guess from the introduction, the short bio that John read, that there's been a lot packed into my short life so far, and so it's difficult to decide what to say. I'm going to just sort of talk a little bit about my early years coming up to a conversion experience, becoming a follower of Jesus, because that's kind of, I guess, what's often of interest when you hear someone's testimony. Lots of other stories Susan and I can tell, but I'm going to start with my own journey. It's been a grace to me to be welcomed into this context, because much of my early formation as a Christian was in Baptist context. So here's a bit of a whirlwind tour. Both sets of my grandparents were immigrants to Canada. My mother's parents were from England, and my father's were ethnic Germans from Russia. So this is the rather severe-looking woman is my great-grandmother, and the young man up here is my grandfather when he was about 14. This picture was taken back in Russia. This is my great-grandparents on my mother's side who came from London, England, didn't know much about farming, came out to the Bald Prairies and set a homestead up in the Adnack-Pippin area between Wilkie and Unity. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that area. But they homesteaded there, and they broke up the prairie sod. The sods were so thick that they served as building materials. My great-grandparents had one of the larger sod houses in the area, and apparently traveling ministers would sometimes come to their house to hold services because it was one of the largest houses in the area. My German from Russian grandparents lived closer to Claybank, and my dad's older sister used to take cream down the railway station to feed the workers that worked in the Claybank brick factory. Have any of you been to the brick factory, the historic site? Fascinating place to visit. We actually visited there back in the 60s when it was still in operation, and we got to see them stamping out the bricks and firing the bricks. That was amazing. My mom and dad were married just a few months before dad was called up to spend 4 years overseas with the Calgary Tank Corps. They spent a lot of time in Italy getting shot at, and dad lost a lot of colleagues there. When dad came home, they were looking for farmland, and there wasn't much left in Saskatchewan where they were looking, but they found a place in northern Alberta, Lesser Slave Lake area. Here's the place where we ended up settling there. And so my own childhood was on a little subsistence farm in northern Alberta. And that's mom and dad and me when I was, I don't know, one or something like that, and my older sister. And when you're a farm kid, you always have fun with horses. And old Pat, the horse was so wide, it was kind of like doing splits just to ride on him when you're a little kid. But we had a lot of fun. And of course, when you're on the farm, spring runoff is always fun to play in the spring runoff. My sister and I are there. Having a Roman Catholic father and sort of an agnostic mother led me to believe that deeply loving relationships are still possible in spite of differences in beliefs and practices about God and about prayer and about church. And so I guess I've always had that idea that just because we don't agree about some things, even very important things, doesn't mean we can't get along and have loving relationships. Our farm was in the Swan River Valley. This is the forage harvester. We used to put up a lot of silage. my dad with his older sister driving the tractor, and then in the fall we were still using a thrashing machine. How many of you were on thrashing crews? How many of you were descendants of prairie settlers and farmers? There you go. You know what it's about. So as a farm kid, I had my first motorcycle, a little Honda 90. We were just talking at our table. That's the one I managed to flip over on the road and get a big scar on my knee.
Because?
Well, I shouldn't say this, but I was trying to learn to ride it by standing on the seat. And it didn't work well. But first motorcycle, first car, 60 Bel Air. Did anybody else drive a Bel Air with a big metal dash? Even the radio knobs were metal. You familiar with that car? They were great cars. I bought that car from a guy at college for $30 and a bottle of shaving lotion. He wanted $35, and I said, well, I've only got 30, but I've got this brand new bottle of, was it High Karate Aftershave or something? Said, that's a deal. Let's make a deal. So that was my first car. In my childhood, my dad took us to the Roman Catholic Church, my sister and I. And I was actually I was an altar boy. That's just a drawing, of course, but I learned to be an altar boy to serve, to help the priest at the altar, just at the time when the liturgy was changing from Latin to English. And I was really thankful because I could barely keep track of the English responses. I was really glad I hadn't had to learn the Latin responses that the altar boys are required to say in the Catholic Church in those days. My early faith consisted of, or my early sense of morality consisted of sort of trying to make deals with God. I would say, well, God, I'll if you do this for me, I'll try to be better, and I'll try not to be so bad, kind of a thing. I know you, some of you are nodding like you understand that experience. The Roman Catholic catechism that we went to, taught by the nuns, suggested to us what Christians should believe. Sort of like, you're a Roman Catholic, and this is what Catholics believe, and so therefore that's what you will believe. But they provided very little by way of why we should believe those things. What was the evidence for it? What were the reasons behind it? And so I found myself wanting reasons that made sense and explained everything on one hand, but I also wanted the kind of truth that you could experience emotionally and psychologically. And so one of the areas that sort of touched me in that emotional way, or that sense of something beyond me, was simply the night sky. When you go out and when you're a farm kid and you look up at the night sky, it's simply amazing. The stars are there, and they are the night sky is immense and hostile, not really amenable to life. But it's also very beautiful. And this struck me that the God who would make something, it was powerful enough to make something as big as that, but would also invest that much beauty in it, must be benevolent. God must be kind, because a God who wasn't kind and loving wouldn't bother making something so hostile, so beautiful. There was always that sort of a contrast in my thinking. And so I call it sort of spiritual aesthetics. I was drawn to want to know God by the beauty that I observed in nature. And I think when you sort of live in the wilds, in the woods, in the rural areas, it's almost easier to not to doubt the existence of God, because most things around you aren't made by humans. When you live in the city, you see buildings and cars and everything that's been made by people, right? But when you're in the country, the things you're looking at weren't made by people. Somebody else was involved in making this creation. I remember walking to the school bus on bright, frosty northern Alberta mornings. And this was another case when I experienced the invigorating cold and the dazzling brilliance of the sun reflecting from the snow crystals. If you just moved your head, the whole thing would shimmer. And such aesthetic awe caused me to contemplate, again, that only a fierce and yet benevolent creator would invest so much beauty in such an austere environment. And so, with my elementary sort of Roman Catholic catechism, I began seeking something more experiential. And I remember we had a little, we had been given little ornate crucifixes like this. So I had this hanging in my room, a little bunkhouse where I used to stay on the farm during the warm weather. And I started burning incense. And I thought, well, maybe that's a thing to do. Maybe worshiping God somehow or other. I was trying to find some connection with the spiritual realm. I was looking for something that was both experiential but also still logically and sort of philosophically valid. And so I found myself engaged in these spontaneous acts of worship. My parents had encouraged me to sort of figure things out for myself and not just embrace popular thinking without evaluating it or without looking for alternatives. My mom used to tell me, well, don't believe something just because everybody else does. And my dad would say sometimes when I'd ask him a question, he'd say, well, you should be able to figure that out for yourself. So I was kind of led into this idea where I sensed they respected me to do my own thinking, to do my own exploring, and yet not to just sort of presume to sort of buy a package of ideas from somebody else. And so being trusted this way to discern the truth for myself seems to have resulted in an intention on my part to make sure I did a good job. I thought if my parents trust me enough to figure out my own values and beliefs in life, I better do a good job of it. I don't want to end up with something that's just kind of goofy or something that is popular but not necessarily valid. And so, influenced by the popular existentialism of the 60s, I began to search for my own reasons to believe, expecting that direct experience was the way to explore reality and discover truth. And I was fascinated with alternative explanations. What else could explain what we see? In the end, I think it was my enthusiasm for life that wouldn't settle for sort of just a limp skeptical agnosticism. People I was talking with at the time were saying, well, we don't know anything for sure. You can't know anything for sure. And I thought, well, maybe, but what a way to live, not knowing anything, you know, and always doubting everything. And so, in a way, I can say that in a way, skepticism brought me to faith in Jesus Christ. It was sort of the method of thinking, of doubting, and yet still seeking, not settling for uncertainty, complete uncertainty, but realizing that knowledge is still somehow contingent, still needs evidence. So I was after both rationalism and experientialism. Is that a word? I don't know. I put it on there anyway. You have my authority. You can use that word if you want.
It is now.
It is now? Very good. Philosophy and mysticism. And to little a glimpse on that, you understand my generation. When I say my generation, I'll give you a few things that were going on that sort of infused the thinking of people my age and in my generation. One of them was that the year I was born, 1952, the first hydrogen bomb was tested at the Bikini Atoll. They'd already used the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This was a new generation of bomb, the hydrogen bomb, even more powerful. So technology was being used to create these implements of mass destruction, as if we hadn't learned enough about the damage, the power, the destruction that could be wrought on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were building more bombs. The year I went into grade 5, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. It was sort of one of the first alarm bells about the effects of pollution, and eventually ended leading to a ban on DDT. Her observation from studying the oceans was that even in the vast and mysterious reaches of the sea, we are being brought back to the fundamental truth that nothing lives to itself. Now, she was talking biology here, but it seems to me that's a pretty fair observation for how we live as social and spiritual beings as well. I don't think that God didn't create us to live alone. We need each other in more ways than one. So there was a growing awareness in my generation that the technology that was being advanced was actually in danger of destroying the planet through bombs or poisoning the planet through pollution. And of course in the background there was the Vietnam War. Where have all the flowers gone? This is, purports to be planes flying Agent Orange over Vietnam. And student protests at the time, 1968, Chicago Convention, they beat up a bunch of protesters. And then in 1970, four students were shot at Kent State. These four young people lost their lives in a protest shot by the military of their own country. And in the midst of all that, young people still looking for a meaning in life. It seems that the optimism about human progress towards peace and prosperity that had been nearly shattered for our grandparents during the so-called Great War, and for our parents in the Second War, that idealism flickered a little bit in my generation, in what you'd call the flower children or the hippies, but it was still against this backdrop of danger and destruction and a general fear, I guess, of poisoning the planet. In the midst of that sort of mixture of hope and fear rose up the Jesus people. And I say, if you look closely, you might find Merv in this picture somewhere. I'm not sure. But there's the one-way signs that we were talking about. A lot of these young people who were sort of looking for something more than the materialism of their parents' generation turned to Christ. 1971, Time magazine called it the Jesus Revolution. About that time, I was working in the... I moved to Olds College and started hanging around with the Baptist young people. This is Pastor Harold Peters at the Baptist Church in Olds. And another Christian family sort of adopted me, Stan and Jeanette Cox, on either side of Sue's mom and dad. And they were sort of a surrogate family for me. Christian family who brought me in as a sort of this wayward wanderer looking for the meaning of life. Very gracious to me. About the same time, I discovered and read C.S. Lewis, and a friend of mine was reading Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, The Cost of Discipleship. And so for the first time reading Lewis, I started to get reasons and answers for the Christian faith. Things that made sense about how Jesus could be both human and divine at the same time, and how he needed to be both human and divine in order to affect our salvation. So, my personal conversion was like this. I remember, now looking back on it, I remember as a child in the Catholic Church praying that sort of God would look after my eternal destiny and trusting him that because of what Jesus had done, he would do that. But I had no real concept of discipleship or lordship. And I remained skeptical about religious institutions. I had little confidence in the religious claims made only on the basis of church authority. But the question was put to me, I mean, as I was reading Lewis, I came to a conclusion that I now believe that Jesus is the Lord, the divine and human Savior sent from God. And I was telling one of the young people in the Baptist Church in Olds that I'd come to this conclusion. And she said, well, you may believe he's the Lord, but have you made him your own Lord? Have you submitted your will and plans and life to his leadership and lordship? And I thought, I guess not. I mean, can you do that? I guess you can. I mean, if he is the Lord and he's alive, then it makes sense to expect him to sort of take charge of my life now. A lot of the focus in those days was making sure that your destiny was secure. Make sure you go to heaven. Make sure you've got your salvation, your ticket, right? But for me, because I was looking for the experience of God, I thought, well, the idea of Jesus participating and leading and guiding me in my daily life here and now, this side of dying and going to heaven, that seemed to make a lot of sense to me as well. So I just simply prayed and said, Lord, I recognize you as the Lord, and I want you to be the Lord of my life. And so then we joined in with the Jesus people that were going on at that time. And one of the centers in Calgary was the Emmanuel Pentecostal Assemblies. It used to be an Alliance Church in years gone by, but the big Jesus is Lord sign is pasted on there. One of the other centers of Jesus people activity was the First Baptist in Calgary, which is where Susan was involved a little bit. The pastors there at the time, Harold Minton and Bob Ball, we were invited, some of us that were students at the time in Calgary were invited into a project for the summer at the Open Door, the little old church manse next door to the First Baptist Church in Calgary. First Baptist Calgary Summer Outreach Program, 1972. Now, I was only a new Christian by a few months, but I was excited about my faith, and he said, come on in, join the group. We're going to do some street evangelism. Some of them were working with children's ministry. There was a band that used to go and play in the parks, and then after the band, we'd go around and talk to the people about Jesus. We'd go out in the mall, and we'd find the hitchhikers traveling through, or the people on drugs who were having a bad trip, and help them get to the detox center or whatever it was they needed. And most of us who became Christians during that Jesus People revival maintained a very sort of experiential approach to faith. We supposed that there were much more than just facts to be encountered in the reality of God. The Jesus people I knew didn't tend to think of themselves as getting their identity necessarily from particular churches or traditions, and our backgrounds ranged from Catholic to Jewish to atheist to occultist, and we were associated with a wide range of evangelical, Pentecostal, and even some mainline churches. We knew our Bibles better than we knew church history, and so we sort of almost identified more with the apostles and the prophets of the Old Testament than we did with particular church traditions. It was while I was at that summer outreach program that I met this young woman. And you can see why I thought she was pretty nice. I think she's actually wearing my t-shirt there. It says Traveling Man on it, right?
No, it wasn't my shirt.
It wasn't your shirt. So Susan and I got together over a process of time. It used to be that I would, I had a lot of girlfriends at the time, but Susan, being a good faithful sister in the Lord, would listen to my problems. I'd go and say, I've got my problem with a girlfriend. What do you think I should do? A few months later, I've got a problem with this other girlfriend. What do you think I should do? So after a while, I ended up with Susan as my girlfriend.
Stutter.
At work, she had me getting rid of her. So, there you go. I went back to First Baptist in 85 to 91 on another project, and I'm just dropping some names here of pastors there that you may know that were there at the time. Pastor Roy Bell was there, senior, and Bob Cron was there. Didn't you know Bob? He used to be area minister here, I think. Wasn't he for a while? Yeah. Bob was at first at the time of there. Carson Pugh was there. And Axel Schober wasn't at first, but he was my professor in the certificate in ministry program that I was taking at the time. But anyway, that's another story. You'll have to come back for part three or four and hear more about that. Any questions? I should have told you there was going to be a quiz, I guess.
How did you become involved with the African church?
Oh, well, that's the rest of the story, I guess. That was a long process. We started going in Olds, Alberta. Sue and I were sort of welcomed in there. I don't know what else to say for sure about it, but
it was a really long story.
Yeah, the Anglican priest there at the time was very, very evangelical, and I said, well, what about all this Anglican tradition? He said, well, I think it's a pretty good boat to fish from. He was using Jesus' fishing analogy, fishers of people, you know. And one of the things that I observed about Anglican tradition that sort of attracted me that way was all the use of the symbols, rituals and symbols. And it seemed to me that a lot younger people are open more and more than ever to the idea of expressing their faith in symbolic ways, through symbolic means. And so to me it was a missional opportunity. If young people are interested in symbolism and ritual, why wouldn't we use those things to to help us in our evangelism and to help us bring people to Christ. Anything else? I know we're just about ready to wrap up. Some of us have meters to pay. Are we good? Do you want? Have you got time for one more quick meditation? This is a story actually that came out of the Vietnam War, and you recognize the picture probably, and some of you know this story. But if you don't know this story, it's worth looking up. Do you remember that image? You may know the story that goes with it. Kim Phuc was the little girl in that picture that was burned with a napalm, and the picture of her. Now, back in the early 2000s, as far as I know, she was still at Faithway Baptist Church in Ajax, Ontario. But just earlier this year, February of 2019, she was in Dresden to receive the Peace Prize because of her work in advocacy for peace. And so her testimony of coming to Christian faith is amazing. And the last little bit, the closing part that I have for you, if you will, is her meditation about her experience and how it brought her closer to God. She says, "If it had not been for war, I would not value peace. Had it not been for pain, I would not know the healing power of love. Had it not been for hatred, I would never have learned to forgive." And she actually met some of the troops that had bombed her village, some of the American soldiers, and embraced them and expressed her forgiveness. "Had it not been for imprisonment, I would not value freedom. Had it not been for living in want, I would not value everything I have. Had it not been for fear, I would not value peace." And so I leave that with you as a meditation. A lot of us have been through a lot of different things, but this speaks to me of redemption. This speaks to me of the power of Christ to redeem any of us, all of us, from whatever it is that life gives us. Amen.